This time on Weather Brains. We take you to the Kennedy Space Center and the launch of STS-115 as the shuttle Atlantis heads for space. We're there with Bill Bubba Bussey of Radio's Rick and Bubba.
If you've ever been to a college football game and felt the excitement of the fans, then that's exactly what it was like here.
We'll learn from NASA officials about the incredibly important role weather plays in launches.
What are the winds aloft? What is the visibility? Those type of things. What are the winds sitting on the launch pad?
And we talk with people who saw the launch.
It was incredible. Incredible.
Also this time, a Weather Brains Extra. Alabama meteorologist Tim Coleman is trying to answer a tricky question. Do gravity waves have an effect on tornadoes?
If we can understand this process and find out that it is going on, we want to find a way to explain it to forecasters out there in the television and National Weather Service fields so they can see it coming.
We'll talk with Tim to learn more about his research. That and more coming up. Welcome to Weather Brains, the weather podcast that's all about weather, put together by a bunch of weather geeks like myself, David Black from The Weather Company in Birmingham, Alabama. How many times have I said weather? Anyway, hello and thank you for joining us. With us this time, James Spann, the lead meteorologist with ABC 3340 in Birmingham, Alabama. Hello to Mr. Spann. How are you, sir?
Hey, David. We've got our party hats on here. It's our 10th birthday party.
Well, happy birthday. You guys have done well in the Birmingham market. You happy to be a part of the group?
Yeah. I can't believe it's been 10 years. I have never worked at a place this long. This is the longest stint of any station in my career. So,
little change there to have some employment for more than a couple of years, huh?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I'm in the television business, but we just kind of float around and you don't have a home. But this is great to work here. And there's a big function this week where the owners are coming down and I got to get OSHA to clean up the weather office here or somebody. I mean, this place is a mess.
Looks like a disaster area, huh?
Yeah, and that's old. You know, anytime we need something clean, we put John on that. It's a good job for him.
We need to bring the boy back into Weather Brains. I don't know what's become of him, but James, that needs to be somebody's assignment to track him down, whether what part of the country he's in, and get him on with us for another show.
And we'll get him back.
All right. And speaking of Weather Brains, we got another one with us tonight, this time in an unusual location of sorts. Mr. Brian Peters, hello, sir. Tell us where you are and what's going on.
Hi, David and James. Well, I'm at the breezy Mount Cheeha State Park. Actually, it's Cheeha State Park. It's on Mount Cheeha, and it's a little breezy up here. It's in the 70s, lower 70s, I believe, about 73 the last time I checked. But the wind is steady from the east, around 17 miles an hour. So I'm accounting for any wind noise you hear.
So any wind noise, which we're hearing a little bit, we know that it's Brian stealing a Wi-Fi connection up atop Mount Cheeha, highest point in Alabama.
It's not stealing, and I learned to do this from James Spann.
Ooh! And James, I understand, knows like every Wi-Fi point in Shelby County and Jefferson County and probably other points, too.
I can find Wi-Fi spots, hot spots, pretty good, but I don't know about that stealing bandwidth. That's something Brian's into. I always use the ones that are freely available.
Well, Brian's kind of had that different side to his personality, if you know what I mean. But anyway, we won't go there. But we've had a pretty interesting tropical situation the past couple of days. James, you want to run down maybe just real briefly what's going on in the tropics? The Atlantic seems to be pretty active right now.
It's very active, David, and it sure looks like this is going to be the year of the Atlantic hurricane. Now, having said that, you know, you can't rule out a Gulf storm. There could easily be one, but every global model just wants to suggest that all of the tropical systems, at least in the next 2 weeks, will follow the track we've seen with these last two. Florence sideswiped Bermuda this morning. Pretty good little blow there. I think they had one station with a wind gust of 111 miles per hour. And Gordon, the one coming up behind it, should pass east of Bermuda this weekend. And that's going to be the problem. I think it's going to be an Atlantic kind of season. Seems like all of the systems are developing in a favorable area to keep them there. However, there's a new wave coming off the African coast that is a little more of a low-latitude system, so we'll watch that. That has the chance to become Helene or whatever. How do you pronounce that? Brian, how do you pronounce that? Helene?
I would say Helene. That's probably how they want to pronounce that one.
Since he's all from right. Helena, I guess.
Helena, that's right.
Well, so what I'm hearing from you is in the short term, at least, tropical season in the Atlantic looks like it's going to be primarily Atlantic, but you expect the unexpected when you get beyond, let's say, what, a week, 2 weeks, something like that?
Yeah, you know, I think the pattern just is going to favor the Atlantic storms, but you might have a little surprise come through the Caribbean and make it into the Gulf. And sometimes you get these homebrew systems that form around the Yucatan tip or somewhere down in there that can come right at us. So we're just not going to rule out the chance of any Gulf Coast hurricane this year, but I think the large percentage of the storms we see will be off in the Atlantic. So somebody else's turn.
Well, the Gulf Coast is a nice place to be right now. We talked about this in the previous Weather Brains podcast about what a great time of year it is getting to be to visit the coast, but also other nice places are some of the state parks in Alabama that Brian Peters is becoming pretty good at finding. You head up there, what, with your trailer, your wife, and your pooch, and you just have a nice time, huh?
Oh, we are. It's been an absolutely fabulous weekend. When we came up on Friday afternoon, temperatures, you know, you go up about 2,000 feet or so when you get up to Mount Cheeha, and temperatures dropped off a very nice 10 degrees, so we left 90 down there, and it was 79 up here when we got here. And it's been around 80 for highs all weekend, so it's been beautiful.
That sounds absolutely outstanding. I'd like to be up there myself, and probably the fall is going to be a great time to be up there. And they've got cabins and all kinds of stuff you can enjoy, but you probably got to get your reservations in pretty quick, I would think.
I would think so, too, David. And one thing that's very interesting, I would have thought, let's see, this is September the 11th. I would have thought that we would see a little bit of color already in the mountainside, but it's amazing. You don't really see any color yet. Now, we took a nice long hike around noontime today, and inside the canopy, you know, down near the ground, there are a few small trees that are beginning to show some red. But other than that, the landscape, the whole countryside looks pretty green so far. And, of course, not much rain up here. We've had very little rain. Most of the streams running very, very low.
James, don't you have a favorite drive over in that general area you like to take during the fall? Is it Skyline? Is that right?
It's called the Skyway Motorway. It's a really neat little drive on the very top of the Talladega Mountains. And typically what I do, I will get on it on the other side of Sylacauga. The road from Sylacauga to Millerville is Alabama 148. Once you top that mountain, you'll see a little U.S. forest sign. It's not a big one, but that's the Skyway Motorway. It is not paved, and I wouldn't take, you know, one of these high-end sports cars up there like Brian drives, but if you got a, you know, a sport utility vehicle or something like that, it's very manageable, and the views up there are just stunning. So to me, that's one of the greatest drives in the fall is the Skyway Motorway, and that ultimately winds over to Highway 77, and you go up to Cheeha from there. And I'm going to be up there at Cheeha the 30th of this month for the Cheeha Chili Cook-Off. I'm going to be one of the judges for that thing, so
wow.
I can't wait to get up there. And I think we probably should have some pretty decent color by September 30th.
That sounds like fun. It sounds like it'll be tasty, too. And I suspect that as the autumn, as the fall season comes upon us, we just might be seeing some span digital pictures of the Skyway drive on the weather blog on abc3340.com. Possibly?
You got it, man. Usually I'll get up there sometime around the first week or two in October and grab some shots, so we'll get them on the blog.
We will be looking forward to it. Well, let me tell you guys about something that I really wasn't looking forward to because I didn't know about it, but it's all about what happens when a tremendous, literally once-in-a-lifetime opportunity comes up and you don't have any notice. It's kind of like you want to go quickly, and the answer has got to be given pretty fast. So what do you say when you get a short notice invitation to head to Florida to watch a space shuttle launch? Well, my answer was, sure. With that, my brother-in-law, Mike Haley, and I boarded a private jet as guests of Bill Bubba Bussey of the Rick and Bubba radio team. Lots of folks know Bill, Rick, and Bubba around here. We would be treated to 2 days of excitement and wonder as we got to see the inner workings of NASA as it prepared the shuttle Atlantis for STS-115, a critically important mission heading to the International Space Station. I took my digital camera and an overnight bag in case we had to stay, which we did, And early Friday morning, we joined Bubba and show producer Don Juan, bound for Melbourne, Florida. That's about 30 miles from Kennedy Space Center and was as close as we could fly to KSC because of airspace restrictions imposed by the FAA. We were in for an experience everyone agrees will never be forgotten. It's Friday morning, September 8th. We're on the fifth floor of the Operational Services Building number 2. The view of the launch site is spectacular. We're 3.5 miles away from Atlantis as it sits atop Launch Pad 39B. Bubba is on his cell phone talking with Rick Burgess, giving radio listeners a live update on what's happening.
From inside the orbiter, we can see the astronauts getting strapped in and getting ready to go. We have the audio from the comm channel being popped out here to us, so we're in hog heaven here for a space fanatic.
But concerns over a possibly faulty sensor caused NASA to scrub Friday's launch. STS-115 is rescheduled for liftoff Saturday, September 9th. But Saturday is not without concerns either. One worry is the thickness of growing cloud cover around the launch site. NASA's Bob Castle spent 15 years as a flight director at the Johnson Space Center in Houston.
Well, weather-wise, it breaks down into two broad categories. One, you have to have sufficient weather that you can actually launch. That's in terms of what are the winds aloft, what is the visibility, those type of things, what are the winds sitting on the launch pad, those important things. And then the other thing that drives the shuttle a lot beyond a typical expendable rocket is if we have a problem and need to abort, the shuttle needs to be able to land successfully, both here at the Kennedy Space Center or at the transoceanic abort landing sites, which are in Spain and in France, those places. So that breaks down into the typical aircraft things. You need to have the winds at the runway within limits in terms of crosswinds. You also need to have visibility such that you can break through your cloud deck and see the runway. So there's a ceiling limit on clouds as well as a limit on winds.
Cloud thickness is one of many critical factors affecting shuttle launches. Al Sofci served as an assistant shuttle launch director at KSC.
We have constraints on the maximum winds, and it involves both the direction as well as the speed. The cloud thickness has to be less than 4,500 feet so that the range safety personnel can adequately monitor the flight of the space shuttle. And the And, of course, we cannot have lightning within 10 miles of the launch pad. And not within 10 miles, but it cannot be moving toward the launch pad and possibly within 10 miles of the flight path.
This is quite a job to monitor.
We have an excellent weather service over on the Cape Canaveral Air Force Station that's a combination of civil servants and Air Force personnel and Air Force civil servants that do an absolutely wonderful job for us. And we've relied on them for many years, and they are some of the top meteorologists in the country.
Lightning is a frequent occurrence around the launch pads. You might wonder what sort of danger lightning poses to the shuttle's electronics. But Sofci says NASA plans for lightning extensively.
It's part of the business. We have lightning protection that protects the vehicle sitting on the pad. So lightning strikes that would affect the vehicle are fairly minimal to almost non-existent. If we take a strike on our lightning protection system, we do some retests. So we have the vehicle protected. And as far as lightning concerns during launch, we don't launch if there is a lightning concern or if there's a chance the vehicle could be struck. So not scary, it's just part of the business.
Saturday morning, the final verdict is in. NASA decides Atlantis will fly. Atlantis has now started its climb. A shockwave I've never before experienced is about to hit all of us watching from OSB2. for people who've seen the shuttle go up before, it's still a thrilling experience. For me, as a first-time viewer, it is powerful, scary, emotional, dramatic. As I watch Atlantis rise into the sky, I'm standing next to Robert Grant with the U.S. Coast Guard Miami. He's here to watch astronaut and Coast Guard Commander Daniel Burbank head for space.
What'd you think?
Unbelievable. I mean, this, it was so important to be here and just see this firsthand, this up close. It was incredible. Incredible.
My friend Bill Bubba Bussey is electrified. For Bubba, a dream has come true.
How cool was that, David Black?
How cool was it for you?
Let me tell you, I love TV. I love high-def TV. Nothing like seeing it in person. If you've ever been to a college football game and felt the excitement of the fans, then that's exactly what it was like here. Two things that were real noticeable to me. It is a lot brighter than it is on TV. When the solid rocket boosters come up, it is extremely bright, and the sound makes this very unusual popping noise that we had been told about. But we are 3 miles away, and I could feel the building shaking like it was a minor earthquake. So, awesome feeling. A lot of power on that launch pad.
Former astronaut Fred Leslie is in our group. Leslie served as a payload specialist aboard STS-73. That was a 16-day mission back in 1995. The launch that we're attending September 9th is not Leslie's first to see in person.
How many of these have you seen?
This was my third one. I've seen two in the day and one at night, and of course flew on one.
They don't get boring to watch, do they?
Certainly not. Certainly not. Anyone who hasn't seen one, I really encourage you to come out and take a look.
You've been up. Tell me about it.
What can you say? One of the best things has got to be the launch, because it's very dynamic. It's loud. It's exciting. There's a lot of acceleration. I mean, that's got to be one of the best parts. And then the look out the window, view out the window is spectacular. The colors that you see are just not reproduced by photographs. And the feeling of weightlessness is just incredible to live and work in that kind of environment.
Fred has brought his wife, Kathy, to see her first launch.
It was more emotional than I expected. I mean, I've seen it on TV many times, but to see it in real life, it was very emotional, especially with my husband standing beside me, and he's flown on it before. It was an incredible experience that I'll never forget.
Michael Gilroy was the captain on our flight to Florida. He had never seen a shuttle go up in person before either.
It was awe-inspiring. It was absolutely a phenomenal event to witness firsthand.
Is it sort of an emotional experience in a way?
Absolutely.
What do you want people to know about the space program after you've seen something like this?
I think the program detractors should spend time with NASA personnel to learn firsthand the amount of work required for a successful launch time after time again.
Many thanks go to Bill Bussey, the folks at NASA, as well as our flight crew, Captain Michael Gilroy, who you just heard, and Phil Pierce. Those two guys got us up and down quickly and safely. And I have to say that I have to take Michael Gilroy's side in this, and the comments you just heard him before you really decide to criticize where we're going and what NASA's doing. Go down there and see what those people are making happen. We come back with a new respect for what it takes to make spaceflight a reality and a new appreciation for the people who devote their lives to it. I would have to say that really, truly was a once-in-a-lifetime experience. I'll certainly never forget it. James, you ever made it to a shuttle launch?
No, and you know, that's just something I've always wanted to do. And I have been down there close. I've been to Orlando, and I have been to Daytona Beach, but the timing has never been good. And I was born in 1956, David, and so I was 13 years old for that first walk on the moon. And you talk about an impressionable age, just tremendous. And I loved watching those Apollo missions. And even before that, as a younger child, the Gemini missions and the Mercury missions, even as a little kid, and just was watched in awe. And I remember the journalists like Walter Cronkite and Frank McGee, who would describe this incredible force, and you know, their boots would be shaking and the glass would be shaking when those things were taken off. And you know, just as a little child, you think, man, one day I'd like to be there. So I think it's just too cool, and it sure sounds like you were not disappointed with your trip.
No, it was absolutely unlike anything I've ever experienced before. And as Bubba said in his interview, watching it on TV and seeing it happen with your own eyes, hearing it with your own ears is a totally those are two totally different experiences. So if the opportunity ever arises, I, for one, and a lot of other people, too, really just highly recommend it.
Well, you guys were very fortunate. I guess one of my greatest fears, if I took off work, and for me, it's kind of a logistical nightmare just getting out of town for a few days. But if I got the whole thing set up, you know, the first thing that's going to happen, it'll be a flight delay because of weather or something else. So I think it's too cool. And even though you guys had a one-day delay, you got a chance to see it go. It's just the luck of the draw.
Absolutely. Very, very grateful for it, and especially, again, to all the people that we were involved with who helped make that happen. It's not just research on space travel that keeps us busy and fascinated. We have plenty to figure out right here on this planet, especially when it comes to meteorology. And that leads us to the work of one Alabama research meteorologist you may recognize from some time he spent on camera at CBS 42, giving the weather here in Birmingham. Tim Coleman is currently conducting research at the University of Alabama, Huntsville. He also worked in various roles for the National Weather Service in Shelby County for nearly 7 years. Tim is trying to answer a key question involving gravity waves. He wants to know if the waves make tornadoes become stronger upon interaction with them. Now, the thinking here is that this might be a way to provide more detailed and helpful warnings to protect the public. Tim, we are weather geeks. We're not weather brains. So with that in mind, can you first define for me what a gravity wave is in a way I'll understand?
Well, David, a gravity wave actually can occur in any fluid, whether it be water, the atmosphere, or otherwise. And everybody is familiar with waves on top of the ocean coming into the beach, or the waves behind a boat in a lake. And those are just another kind of gravity waves. The gravity waves in the atmosphere are similar. They're just propagating through the air. You can't really see them, but they move through the atmosphere in a wave-like pattern. And we've kind of learned over the past 20 or 30 years in the weather community how to look for these on satellite and on radar and things like that, and see that they're there. And we've also learned they can have a pretty big impact on the weather at the ground.
These waves are caused, for example, by movement of a thunderstorm?
Well, there's still a lot we don't know about them. We know several ways that they're caused. They can be caused by a thunderstorm itself can generate gravity waves out the top. A jet streak in the atmosphere or area of real high wind can, you know, kind of jerk the atmosphere a little bit and create one. Anything that disturbs the atmospheric balance can create these waves. Much like when you disturb the surface of a lake, you create waves. If you disturb the balance in the atmosphere, you create waves kind of in response to that.
You're looking into possible connections now between gravity waves, as I understand it, and tornadoes. Has this been researched before, or are you treading through new territory?
Well, as far as I know, and I've looked around to be sure, I'm one of the first, at least. A few people have looked into this in a little bit less detail in the past. One of the guys down at the National Weather Service in Birmingham, Bob Kilduff, actually looked at a case back in 1999 where he suspected that a gravity wave interacted with a storm and caused a tornado to form. He looked at it from the standpoint of, you know, this is what happened on radar, but I'm not attempting to explain it. And a couple of other guys have done studies like that. And what I'm trying to do, I and my research partner and boss, Dr. Kevin Knupp, up in Huntsville at UAH, we are trying to figure out how these gravity waves could interact with a storm that, say, doesn't already have a tornado and cause it to produce one, or even interact with a tornado that's already there and make it more intense. We have several examples of this occurring if we go back and look at the radar data. And I think, David, that as I've gotten into this, it happens a lot more than I thought it did.
And you've been looking at the April 8th, 1998 tornado that folks in Birmingham are very familiar with as one case, right?
Right. We have several cases that we're evaluating. And we're looking at the April 8th case because that storm, as a lot of the people will remember, came out of Tuscaloosa County. And it was already, it already had a tornado on the ground in eastern Tuscaloosa County. But that tornado was something like F1. But then a some type of odd-looking little thin line on the radar was coming up from the south and intersected that storm just as it was crossing into Jefferson County, and the tornado spun up to F4 damage very quickly once this little line on the radar came in.
So is it your belief that that little line was a gravity wave?
We think that's possible, and you know, we're not sure about that. Like I said, there's several cases we're looking at, but it behaves kind of like some of the others. We've got two or three cases where we're pretty sure of it, that it is a gravity wave coming in. And it's fascinating because essentially what happens, David, is that as the wave approaches, and it's called a gravity wave. That makes it sound like something, you know, outer space related or something. It's not. It's just that the wave moves along the Earth's surface, you know, based on gravity. That's all it means.
So I guess you can't necessarily prove this yet, but seeing that little line on the radar on that April 8th tornado would certainly suggest that that storm drew tremendous strength out of the interaction with that?
Well, that's right. And, you know, like I said, as far as the April 8th case is one of those that we're not sure about yet in terms of there are a lot of things that can cause these little boundaries on radar, thunderstorm outflows and other things that can cause these boundaries, but we do suspect that one was a gravity wave. We're also looking at the Nashville tornado of April 16th, 1998. A very similar feature came up from the south and interacted with that storm before it produced the tornado in downtown Nashville. And similar, several other cases we're looking at. The Lawrenceburg, Tennessee tornado of that same day that was actually an F5. Down in southern Tennessee, and the December 16th, 2000 tornado in Tuscaloosa also had what I'm pretty sure are gravity waves, actually two or three of them coming up from the south and interacting with it as it grew in strength and produced that tornado in Tuscaloosa. But I think the most promising case of all this may be that Tuscaloosa storm.
Well,
it looks like the clearest, so far, the clearest interaction of those are gravity waves, and there's three of them coming. And this storm was not producing a tornado, and then, kaboom, there it is.
I guess having the 88D radar system is really very valuable to you in being able to even do this kind of research.
Well, that's right. 10 years ago, we just didn't have the radar data at our fingertips to go back and say, well, I want to go examine in detail the radar data from a date in 1998. Here we are in 2006, and now we have that capability. The 88D radar is a, you know, fantastic machine. It's very high resolution. It, you know, as you know, it can pick up bugs out as far as 30 miles away from the radar. And, you know, it picks up very fine details. And these gravity waves typically produce these very small little bands on the radar that would probably not have even been picked up by the older radars back, you know, 15 and 20 years ago that we were using before the Doppler radars came along.
So if you're able to collect radar data from all these different tornadoes you're talking about, if you are able to find, in effect, the little line, so to speak, in a lot of those cases, does that give more credibility then to your theory that maybe these waves really are having some profound effect on development of a tornado?
Well, that's what we're looking at. I mean, the focus ultimately of our research at UAH is to save lives and to help the operational community. I actually worked at the Weather Service for several years, so I kind of know how it is when you're in a tornado situation. And any kind of little extra piece that you could add to your pie, so to speak, when you're trying to sit there and look at the radar and decide whether or not to issue a tornado warning, you know, you may see a storm that's marginal, and you might decide not to issue a tornado warning on it, but if you saw one of these little thin lines approaching from the south, and we can actually go through this research over the next year or two and prove that, yeah, this does have a big impact and can cause this to produce a tornado. If you saw that coming up from the south, that might allow you to issue a warning maybe 10 or 15 minutes earlier than you would have before.
And I take it that then would be what your ultimate hope is, that the possible benefit from having developed an understanding of the relationship here might be a tool to use in the warning process.
That's exactly right. I mean, that's, you know, to me, that any research, you know, ultimately, it's that people have that little phrase, things are just academic. Well, you know, if we can't apply it in some way to the real world in the, you know, in forecasting or in whatever field you're doing it in, it's academic, so to speak. And in our case, we really don't want that to happen. Now, we want to, you know, we're getting into some pretty deep physics on some of this stuff. But at the same time, you know, ultimately, we want to be able to, if we can understand this process and find out that it is going on, we want to find a way to explain it to forecasters out there in the television and National Weather Service fields so they can see it coming. And the National Weather Service guys, in some cases, you know, we're not saying that this is associated with every tornado by any means. It, you know, it could be 5%.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Does this not mean that you also have to be alert to the possibility that some waves might interact with storms and do nothing?
Well, sure. I mean, first of all, you know, this research has only been going on since the first of this year, and we don't figure to finish it, really, and get the stuff published until at least the end of next year. This is actually my dissertation topic for PhD, and, you know, we'll be working on it for at least another year or two, and then publishing some papers out in journals, and if it works out, then we'll go out and talk at Weather Service offices about it. But, first of all, you know, we're by no means even thinking that more than just you know, a relatively small percentage of tornadoes have anything to do with the gravity wave. And secondly, yes, that is possible that one of these, just like anything else, you know, we see mesocyclones on radar all the time, or little areas of rotation, and nothing happens. And same here. I mean, you could have a mesocyclone and have one of these waves approaching it on radar, and still nothing happens. Certainly, that, you know, and that's the thing. We don't know how often that happens, because we're actually going back and just looking at the cases where it did happen.
One thing James Spann has mentioned many times as a great concern of his is false alarm ratio.
Right.
Could this ultimately be a tool to help reduce that?
That's a tough question, because probably this would be more of something that you would, if anything, it would increase the number of tornado warnings, or at least make them earlier, so it probably wouldn't help. you know, the thing that we're more looking at here is in cases where a tornado is going to occur, and it does seem that a lot of the significant tornadoes that have happened, we're mainly looking in Alabama and Tennessee, but a lot of these significant tornadoes over the past 8 years or so have had some type of involvement with something that we at least suspect is a gravity wave. And so our main goal is to increase the lead time on the tornadoes that are actually occurring. Now, anything you do where you make it potentially better to detect the tornado, or if you come up with something that makes it more likely that a person could issue a tornado warning on a storm, even though, you know, it's a trade-off, you might make it more likely to catch a tornado or two that you might not have seen before, or give people an extra 10 minutes to take the appropriate measures, go to the basement and so forth. You're also trading off the fact that sometimes you're going to issue a warning and nothing's going to happen.
And you may be saving some lives doing this. Who knows with this research?
Yeah, we don't know, and that's the thing. We're looking at the interaction right now on several different fronts. We think that these waves not only can, as they approach the storm, the convergence within the wave can spin up any existing rotation, but we also are starting to look at the possibility that the waves actually alter the environmental winds just temporarily as they go by, and as they do that, they would change the wind shear and potentially add an extra piece to the puzzle of throwing in some wind shear, which, you know, can be turned into rotation in a storm.
Well, it sounds like you might be taking the first little baby steps toward developing a warning tool that may ultimately give people more advance notice and thus save some lives. So thanks for your work and best of luck with what you find and learn.
Well, David, I appreciate it.
Let me ask you one other thing here, just so we know that you're not an all-science guy. You went fishing on the Warrior River the day before we did this interview. Did you catch anything?
Very little. Caught a few brim. I think that the brim around the dock there have learned, and they see me coming, and you know how hard it is to catch those little guys. They'll just, you know, pull your bait off the hook and go on with it, and I've gotten to where I just feed them now. And I caught a couple of bass. But it seems like the fishing this year has been better than it's been the last 5 or 6 years. Maybe because it's been warmer. I don't know. But
overall, it sounds like you better not quit your day job, huh?
No, definitely not. These guys that can go out there, I see them show up on the water, these tournament guys with their bass boats. You know, I've been sitting there 3 hours sweating and laboring, not catching anything. They'll drive up, and within 5 minutes, they'll have a 3-pound fish in the boat. I don't know what I'm doing wrong.
Yeah, there's no justice in the world.
No.
Tim, thanks for talking with us very much. We really enjoyed it.
Okay, well, thanks, David.
Take care, Kim. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Tim Coleman will be presenting his findings at a November 6th American Meteorological Society conference in St. Louis. Interesting work.
Let me tell you what, David. This gravity wave concept has been a great mystery to a lot of people in the science for many years, and I think all of us could be included in that. And Tim's work is timely. It is excellent. I heard Tim present some of his research at a meeting at the National Weather Service in Birmingham, and he gets a big attaboy for opening this up. This will greatly help us, I think, down the road when it comes to detecting tornadoes that previously might have been undetected. I think he's right. I'm not so sure this is going to cure the false alarm ratio problem, but I think it will cure some of the problems with tornadoes, especially the smaller ones that can go undetected.
J.B. Elliott is joining us in the last few minutes of our podcast. J.B., you have a history, too, with Tim Coleman. What do you think of his research?
I think his research is very good. I had talked to him earlier about it, and I'm especially interested in the potential that the gravity wave may trigger a tornado when otherwise one would not occur. And I'm definitely one of those guys that a gravity wave is still a great mystery to me.
It's amazing to think that maybe some point in the future we will have severe weather warnings that take those into account, that maybe the weather forecasting process, or severe weather detection process, I should say, will be refined enough that we can know in advance what a gravity wave is going to do.
Maybe. I still think it's a mystery when I think it's still difficult to ascertain when they're underway, when one first gets underway.
Mm-hmm.
And I really believe that a gravity wave has to be well in progress before you recognize that's what's going on.
I was going to say, David, I think that's part of our problem in the operational business. It can be easy, not always, but it can be easy to go back and look at a set of data after an event is over. And you comb through the data and you look through all the radar images and all the upper air and surface data, and you can find things like that. But in real time, when you are sitting there under the gun with a tremendous amount of pressure and you're on television, and for the Weather Service guys, it's hard to do it in real time, and I think that's going to be the challenge for the research community, is coming up with techniques for operational people like us to determine gravity waves and things like that in real time. We'll get there, but it's going to take a while.
Okay. In the heat of battle, it's almost impossible to really dig into anything and see what's going on.
Okay, anything else, guys?
I'm just glad J.B. Elliott's here. I mean, you know, without him on the show, it's just disasters. So.
Well, goodness. We're glad you made it in, J.B. It's always a pleasure.
And if you notice, Peter's kind of dropped out. That, you know, when you steal Wi-Fi, you know, sometimes you just kind of lose those connections. So I think that's what happened there.
Maybe the Wi-Fi police showed up. Anyway.
I think so. They probably just shut him off and hauled him to jail up there or something. So.
Anyway, but we'll
always enjoy it, but I don't want to be a pest and be on every single time. People will get tired of hearing me.
And let me plug the blog, David, because you put some tremendous pictures from your trip on there. And for those of you that don't know, it's alabamawx.com, alabamawx.com. That's the address for our blog. And you can see David's pictures, remarkable pictures, and his story from the Kennedy Space Center there. And I noticed even Peter's During the show, put up some pictures of some donkeys up there from Mount Sheehaw. So I don't know what that's all about, but it's on there, too.
There's competition on the blog. And speaking of good websites, forget not about weatherparty.com, another good one to hit and visit, too.
One of our family websites. Anytime there's something happening, like the earthquake in the Gulf or big stories, you'll find it over there in a hurry. And it's edited by our users, the people that are, that are reading the website. It's great information, so that's a good one, too.
Good deal. A reminder that the opinions you hear expressed here on Weather Brains are strictly those of the speaker, not necessarily those of ABC 3340. If you'd like to contact us, our email address is question@weatherbrains.com. Our phone number, if you'd like to leave a voicemail, is 206-339-5482. 206-339-5482. For James Spann, J.B. Elliott, and Brian Peters up there on Mount Cheehaw, I'm David Black. We thank you for listening and hope you can join us again for the next edition of Weather Brains. Weather Brains is copyright 2006. All rights reserved. Adios. Gentlemen, thank you guys. Good show.
Great show, man. Thanks.
Lots of fun.
All right, bye.
Y'all keep out of trouble.
All right, bye-bye.
See you
tonight.